qualify briefly. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Maynard. You know, when I was out there doing my thing, my life was just a total mess. You know, I was so filthy, so dirty. I mean, thinking of AA as a brainwashing kind of a click, I thought, what the heck, I needed a whole total washing. But when I came into these rooms the last time, I was serious. I mean, this was it for me. I came in with a little bit of honesty, a little bit of open-mindedness, and a whole lot of willingness. And with that whole lot of willingness, the doors were opened. I love my life the way it is now. Sobriety, it's the AA and sobriety are the only way for this alcoholic to live a meaningful life. And I wouldn't change anything for the world. Thank you. Okay. Introducing John. I've known John now for a little over 4 years since coming here. And I've always enjoyed every time he shares. He's always got something that makes me think whenever he shares. So I hope he hits you guys the same way. John, come on up here.
Thanks, Jim. I wasn't nervous till I pulled in the parking lot. But this is not the first time I've been up here, and hopefully, I don't know. I want to take a moment. You know, we have that moment of silence at the beginning of a lot of meetings where I like to ask my higher power to come into my life and help me hear what's being said, and if I have an opportunity to share, to help me with what I share. So I'm going to take that moment now, and you do with it as you feel free to do, and I'm going to... Thank you. Again, my name is John. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 18th of 2001. And I got sober in a treatment center called Mary Haven up in Columbus, Ohio. I lived down here in Orlando at that time, but a couple of weeks, maybe a week or so prior to that, I had a call from one of my four sisters, and she had got wind of how bad things had gotten. But before I get there, I'll back up and try and do the how it was and what happened and what it's like now. I'm the youngest of six kids. I was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio. I believe I'm the only alcoholic in the family. My mother and father never drank, and I can say that for my dad, never. I had to ask him after I sobered up. It's really never drank, never took a drink, and he has continued to tell me no. He's never tried a beer, had champagne at weddings, anything like that. And my mother didn't drink. My oldest sister got married. There was no alcohol at the reception. My brother got married. No alcohol at the reception. Family reunions, it was Kool-Aid and iced tea. You know, Christmas gatherings, it just wasn't around. Was raised Presbyterian and vacation Bible school and all that kind of good stuff. And really a normal life. I think I said this the last time. You know, my family, though, as normal as it was we were somewhere between... the Adams family comes to mind, but between them and normal, I don't know. But we had a blast. We had a very loving family, and they're all still up in the Columbus area, except for one in Tennessee. But life was normal. Summer vacations were spent tent camping with eight of us in a tent, and it seemed to rain 5 out of 6 days or 12 out of 14 days. And, you know, if anyone's tent camp, that's, you know, I loved it. And we loved it. And my mother worked very hard to keep us fed those days and always washing dishes or cooking or something. But life was good. There's a part of our book that tells us that the alcohol was but a symptom, though. There's something else going on. And I really didn't know what that was until I got a chance to look back at it. And our family didn't move until I was 13 years old. It was the first time I ever moved in my life. And we just moved one time. And we moved about 5 miles from the house we lived in, and I was terrified. I was in the last year of junior high, which back then was 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And so for the 9th grade, I went to a new junior high school. And I swore that everybody knew everybody. They had been together all their lives. It wasn't like, you know, people move around as much as they do today. And the 9th grade was the worst year of, I believe, of my life, except maybe the last year of drinking. It was very close. It was miserable. I wasn't drinking or anything, but my life was miserable. I was scared to death. I had my parents commute me back and forth to the old neighborhood to play street hockey and hang out with the friends that I had on that side of town, all of 5 miles away. So that 9th grade was just, it was a wreck. The summer before I went to high school, I was still trying to get my parents to, or I was taking the city bus or riding my bike or whatever to go back to the old neighborhood. And finally my mother said, I'm not doing this anymore. You need to find some friends here in this neighborhood. In fact, every time I come home from wherever I'm at, whether she's going to the grocery store or coming home from work, she had realized that right around the corner there was this large white house, and it had always had kids in the front yard playing. I mean, there must have been 5 or 6 kids in that yard every time she turned the corner. You need to go down there and introduce yourself and let them know you're, you know, new in the neighborhood. And I was not about to do that. Walk down there and knock on a door and say, you know, hi, my name is Johnny. I've been in the neighborhood for like a year now, but I finally decided to come down and say hello. But to make my mom happy, I said, okay, I'll go do this. And I headed down towards that house that I was terrified and had no plans to go up and knock on the door. And in front of that house was the elementary school, and there was a big field with a large tree and a large tree fort. I said, well, I'll just go hang out in that tree fort for an hour or so and then go home and tell Mom everything was fine. So I headed up that tree, and I got about halfway up that tree, and about 6 or 8, a lot of guys came out of that same house that I was supposed to go knock on the door, and they started hollering at me and cussing at me and telling me to get out of their effing tree fort and this and that. And I got down as fast as I could, and one of the kids said, hey, aren't you that kid that's down in the church parking lot all the time playing roller hockey by yourself? Yeah, that would be me. And I spent a lot of time stick handling and shooting a puck at the side of the church, and that's what I did to kill a lot of time, because I was so shy I wouldn't go see anybody else, wouldn't do anything else. And anyways, we struck up a conversation, and they said something to the effect like, well, we're going up in the tree fort now to get high and drink some beer. Do you want to come? Yes, I do. And that was the beginning. I went up in the tree fort, and I spent a little time up there with them. And I went home and tried to quickly go to my bedroom. And I told my mom everything's fine. And, you know, got by that first night without getting in trouble with her, and learned quickly how to, you know, get high and drink beer and not get caught. And in fact, me and one of those guys, we were in the same grade. We became best friends. We shared I think 8 packs of Little Kings before the first day of high school. So I walked into high school with a good buzz on. The teachers knew me that way, so it was not uncommon for me to have that buzz on. And that buzz lasted all 3 years of high school. I managed to graduate on time with fairly good grades. That friend of mine played football, so I stayed, you know, kind of active with that. My sister was in a band. I was always under the bleachers or behind the bleachers or hanging out in the parking lot, and never knew the score. When I, you know, come home from the game, Dad would say, who won? I don't know. You know. Whatever. But at some point in time, they caught on, and they realized things that I was probably experimenting with, or sampling, whatever you want to call it. And in fact, my senior year of high school, I got into some trouble with the law for having some drugs on me that weren't legal at the time. Still aren't legal now, probably. But anyways, and that really shocked my parents, because up to that point they thought maybe I had, you know, been drinking a little bit and had, might have tried pot, but I they did not think that I was doing any kind of chemicals or anything like that. Which I was, but I graduated on time, and about 3 weeks after graduation, me and that best friend of mine, it's Victor, I mean, he don't care, but anyways, Victor, we were both, he had an older brother that worked on the Delta Queen steamboat, and so we drove from Columbus down to Cincinnati and applied for jobs on the Delta Queen steamboat, and about 3 weeks later, we both got the call, and they wanted to fly us out to St. Louis. They gave us both jobs and said, the boat's in St. Louis, we need you in St. Louis, you know, you're hired. Cool. You know, this is, we're not 2 weeks older than 18, because actually I'm a few weeks older than him. So once he turned 18, that's when it happened. And we both went out to St. Louis. And the first trip was from St. Louis to Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I believe it was like a 14-day trip up the river on the paddle wheel. I was a busboy and he was a porter on the boat. And we didn't see any monies or tips or anything the whole time up there, but they fed you on the boat and you lived on the boat. And then when the people got off the boat, we started getting these little yellow envelopes full of 20s and 10s and $50. And all of a sudden, at 18 years old, I've got about $1,000 in my hand. And we're in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and we are excited. And it is noon on a Friday. And he's Irish. I won't give his last name, but he is Irish. And he's actually one of 10 brothers and a sister in that family, that house that I didn't want to go up to. Anyways, he's one of them right in the middle. There's some older, some young. But the first place we found was an Irish pub. And we didn't know what the drinking age was in Minnesota. But we thought we'd give it a shot, and we went in and we ordered beers, and they served them to us, and we're like, oh, this is cool, you know. We're sitting. This is the first time I'm sitting in a bar, because in Ohio it was 21, it was 18, but then it got turned to 19 in one of those deals. So I never sat in a bar until this time, and we had a couple of beers, and then he ordered some Irish whiskey, and we had about 3 shots, and it's about 12:30, and we're getting thrown out of the bar. At 12:30 on a Friday afternoon in downtown Minneapolis, and I have to go to the bathroom really bad, and so I just chose to go between a couple of parked cars, which I got away with. And by the time we got back to the boat, I was unable to walk anymore. So he's my friend's kind of carrying me. You know, the river is always downhill, so he's carrying me down the steps to the boat, and we got folks disembarking, and we got people embarking. And so there's luggage all over the bow of the Delta Queen steamboat, which I did proceeded to throw up all over. And my best friend drug me down to my room and threw me in bed, and I missed the sailing buffet as a busboy. I was unable to do that. I didn't miss the boat, but I missed the dinner function. And I woke up at probably 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning going, oh shit, you know, I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'm going to be fired. I know I'm going to be fired. Probably no way home. Don't know where my money is and all that. I don't know what happened to it. So I went down to the dining room and I'd done the work of all 3 bus boys. I set the entire dining room up, done all the side station work, just praying that when the other 2 bus boys came down and the maitre d' came down, that I could somehow salvage my job. And the maitre d' finally came down, and I was being all apologetic and probably crying and bleeding for my job. And he goes, you know, don't worry about it, John. That happens to all of us once. Happens again, wherever we're at, you find a way home. Well, it didn't happen that bad anymore. I mean, but every time we stop, the crew on that boat was knocking passengers out of the way to get off and go to the closest saloon. I was in St. Louis at least 20 times and never made it to the Arch, because I didn't think they sold beer in the Arch. All of these places up and down the Mississippi, Ohio rivers that had plenty to see, all I seen was the inside of the closest bar. New Orleans, we loved. We got down there always ahead of time because we're going downriver. And so we loved pulling into New Orleans and partying all night. And Anyways, let's speed this up a little bit. I was only on that boat for about a year and a half. But by the time I got off that boat at 19 and a half, I knew I was full-blown alcoholic, drinking hard liquor before breakfast, if not before breakfast, between breakfast and lunch. There was no problem having a buzz before I was serving lunch, and certainly by the time I was serving dinner. And then after dinner, we were shooting craps and playing cards and drinking until it was time to set up the dining room for breakfast. So I know by 19, I'm full-blown alcoholic. I got off that boat, moved to Florida, lived up in Jacksonville, and I think my drinking kind of slowed down a little bit. I took a job at the front desk of a hotel, an oceanfront property, and had a roommate that didn't drink very much. We would go into Jacksonville once in a while and party, but for 2 or 3 years, the drinking was just steady, but it wasn't too bad. My girlfriend from Columbus moved down to Florida too, and then we both ended up here in Orlando, and she got me a job at one of the properties over on Disney property, or close to Disney property, and I started working there, and I spent about 15 years there, almost 15 years there, and within 4 or 5 years, I was made the beverage captain, and so my office was like a small ABC store with no windows. Only about three or four of us had, only about three or four of us had keys to it. We had a TV in there. Life was pretty good. I loved that job. I would go in on my days off and do paperwork and drink Grand Marnier and Absolut or whatever it was that I felt like. After work, we would watch football games or whatever was on, you know, whatever was going on in state. It wasn't uncommon to be there 3 or 4 hours after the last function was over, just drinking the hotel's beverages. And then I would always empty out the 7-Up bottles and fill it with vodka and put it in my bag and take 2 or 3 bottles of 7-Up full of vodka home or to drink on the way home. During that time, I managed to get one DUI, and then I finally lost that job. When I lost that job and I started looking for work, that's when this stuff really hit home, because I realized that I could not fill out an application because my hand was shaking so bad, because I'm trying not to drink. You don't have 3 or 4 beers before you go try and get a job. And when I realized I couldn't do that, I could not stay sober till 11 o'clock. You know, you'd think you could go out and put out a couple applications and look for work until 10 or 11, and I could not do it. I would look at my own application and go, this is ridiculous, you know. And in 2000, I had 7 jobs. And I only know that because I had 7 W-2 forms. 2 of them, to this day, I don't know where I worked. It's one of those things where I must have got a job. I worked 2 or 3 days. I was let go, and it just doesn't come back to me. Just last year, I remembered that I worked at Dubstred because somebody brought it up in a meeting. I worked at that Dubstred I worked there for a little while. Maybe that was one of them. Yeah, that's how, you know, people talk about blackout drinking, and it's like, no. I went to a party in 1979 and stumbled home in 2001. You know, the 80s and 90s are just literally a blur. I had 2 marriages. One I'm still married to my wife, Beth Ann. We had children during that time. One quick story about when my daughter was born, and then I'll get into what happened on June 18th. But my daughter, my wife went into labor, and she was in labor kind of all night long and didn't really bother me with it until about 5 o'clock in the morning. She said, "Yeah, I think it's time to go to the hospital." And when she stood up, her whatever happened went from 5 minutes to 1.5 minutes. And all the way down the East-West Expressway, they were 1 minute apart. And we get to the hospital and the emergency room, and or wherever, right there, the doorway, and the lady looks at it and goes, "Okay, we got to go." Within a half hour, my daughter is born. No epidural, no nothing. We didn't have any time for any of that. But my wife had done such a good job of packing that suitcase, she didn't forget anything. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, my daughter's an hour old. I'm jonesing for a drink. I mean, I've got to have a drink. And I'm trying to figure out what I can tell my wife, how I'm going to explain this to her, that I need to go home because my Captain Morgan's wasn't in the suitcase. You know, that was, you know, if the Captain Morgan's would have been in the suitcase, everything would have been fine. But it wasn't. So within 2 hours of my daughter being born, I excused myself from the room, drive home, get my Captain Morgan's, and it's just like love. You know, it's like, oh, now I can go back, and now I can enjoy my daughter. I mean, that's where alcohol, that's the kind of control that alcohol had over me. And in fact, just before I got sober, Family and Children's Services are knocking at our door, and my four-year-old, who I'm taking to preschool every day, the folks at the preschool didn't like the fact that I smelled of alcohol at 9 o'clock in the morning, let alone at noon when I'm picking him up, but at 9 when I'm dropping him off, I'm already smelling like alcohol. So they called Family Services. Family Services came over to the house, and they said, we need to take your son for observations. And I said, no, you can't have my son. They said, well, it's either that or you go to jail. I said, here's my son. You know. My wife's at work. My wife is at work. I'm supposed to be watching the kids. My daughter by now is in school in elementary school, and my son is going to pre. It's like, it was a mess. So, anyways, one of my best friends, who I had separated with when I'd lost that job of 15 years over at the hotel, but she had stayed in touch, and she knew that things were really going downhill bad. And she got a hold of my ex-wife, who gave her the number of my family up north. And she talked to my sister, and I would say it was 4 or 5 days before I actually went to Columbus, Ohio. One of my sisters, Joanne, called me. And this is one of those moments that I think we remember our whole lives, what was going on. But my sister called and said, John, you know, we got wind of how bad it is, and your brother and the rest of your sisters have decided that if you want, we're going to fly you home. I found a treatment center for you, and we bought an airline ticket for you if you're willing to accept help. Now, I don't know why I said, okay, I'm done. You hear people in these rooms, and a lot of this is, you know, this part of the story is mine, but then I borrow stuff from what I hear in these rooms. But that was the day I just folded up the tent, and it said, you know, I surrendered. I laid down my guns. It was all over at that moment. When I told my sister, okay, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. And I believe at that moment I felt such a relief that I knew it was going to be all right. So within 2 days, I was on a plane to Columbus, Ohio, and they were smart enough to know to get me a nonstop, one way, nonstop. Because if it would have been in Atlanta or Philadelphia or anywhere else besides Columbus that I could have gotten off and changed my mind, I might have. But it was a nonstop to Columbus. I got there, and I thought I was going right to a treatment center. But I didn't. They said they had to call this treatment center, and when the bed became available, I was going to go in. I told my sister, you don't understand, though, I can't quit drinking. If I quit drinking, I'm going to have DTs. I'm going to go into DTs, and it's going to get ugly. She did not have a clue as to what I was talking about, and she wasn't buying it. But I had to convince her, call the people at this treatment center and tell them how I drink. Let me explain to them how I drink. And she did, and they told her, please, let him drink. Let him drink until we get the room. And so my sister and brother-in-law went out and got a suitcase of Budweiser, and me and my brother-in-law sat and drank probably 6 apiece on the back porch, or I had 10 and he had 4, I don't know. But the next morning, still no bed, another suitcase. The next morning, still no bed, another suitcase. On Sunday night, I told my sister, I said, I can drink a suitcase of beer at home, meaning here in Orlando. If this is not working, I'm going home. But the bed became available, and that was June 18th of 2001. And they picked up one of my other sisters, and we went out there, and out in the parking lot of that place, they said, do you want to pray about this? And I don't know why, but I said, yeah, I think I need all the help I can get. And we said a little prayer, and we walked in that place, and I'd already had 4 or 5 beers, but it was just perfect. You know, 4 or 5 beers in the morning was just you know, perfect. But the nurse looked at me and said, "No, are you all right? You know, it looked like you're going to fall out." And I said, "No, I think I'm going to be fine." And I didn't really know what I was saying at that point, but I've been fine, you know, kind of fine ever since. I was only in there for 14 days. And 7 days I was in like ISO. And then the last 7 days I was allowed to go home if I had a safe place to go. And my father, like I said earlier, there was no alcohol in our house. So I went to live, you know, with my father. And so the treatment center was only 8 to 5. And I would go back to my father's house. But they said, you have to go to an AA meeting every night that you go home. If you stay at the treatment center, you don't have to go to an AA meeting. But if you go home, we'd like you to find a meeting and go to. So I started going to some AA meetings up there. And that might have been one of the first times I laughed, because a guy talked about this AA stuff is very confusing, because they talk about being selfish and self-centered being the root of the problem, but then they turn around and ask you to come up and talk for 45 minutes. So, you know, how's that work out? Anyways, I'm ready to go. Treatment center's over. 14 days is gone. I haven't had a drink in 14 days. Actually, let me back up. 4 days into it, one of the nurses said to me that we took you off your meds 2 days ago. So right now, there's no alcohol in your system. There's no drugs in your system that we use to keep you from going through the DTs. So you don't have anything left in your body except the results of 25 years of heavy drinking, which was enough. But I was amazed. I could not believe that I hadn't had a drink in 4 days and that I wasn't on any kind of drugs. And they said, you don't even have to, you know, you're already sleeping through the night. I hadn't slept through the night if I hadn't passed out in years. But I was sleeping through the night. It was coming up on the 4th of July, and I had a choice to either come right back home 2 or 3 days before the 4th of July, or stay up there until after the 4th of July. And I don't know why, but I didn't feel safe enough coming home yet. So I said, I talked to my wife and the kids were okay and everything was down here was going all right. So I stayed up there and got through the 4th of July and then came back here to Orlando. And before I left that treatment center, they wanted me to have a little game plan going. And said I'd find some meetings down there in Orlando. Gotta find a job. I haven't had a job for a while, so I need to start working and pay the mortgage, and I'll go to church and I'll find a meeting. So that's what I planned on doing when I got back home. And the day I got home, back to Orlando, I went to a meeting. That was a Saturday, and then Sunday I went to a meeting and went to church. And Monday I started looking for work, and I found a job. Monday afternoon I found a job. And it wasn't very far from home. And so I started working. I kept going to meetings. I was going to East Side Club when I first got sober. And I was down there every day. And I was about 2 months into it. And I had heard about the 90 and 90. And I had heard about a sponsor. But I hadn't got the courage to ask anybody to be a sponsor yet. But I was going to do the 90 and 90. And I was, like I said, 2 months into it. And work called me on my... I hadn't been to a meeting yet, but they asked me if I could come into work. And I was like torn. I was like, oh man, I haven't been to a meeting. That's going to mess up that 90 and 90, but I really need to work. There's no way I can tell my wife I'm passing up work. So I went to work, and the next day at the meeting, as just as innocent as I could, I almost, you know, apologizing to the group. Like, I'm sorry I didn't make the meeting yesterday, but I'm going to go to 2 today. And, you know, they said, no, why don't you just start the 90 and 90 over and everything's fine. But I got that, you know, I kept going to meetings. I finally mustered up enough courage to ask somebody to be my sponsor. We did the first 3 steps after the meeting, because he had already seen me at 60-some meetings, and he was going to 60, and I picked somebody who was at a lot of meetings, and kind of liked what they were sharing. It made sense to me. I believe sponsorship is very important. I don't think that shopping around is too good, because you can always find a reason not to pick a sponsor, but anyways, it worked out. And I got started on the steps, and I continued to come to meetings on a regular basis. But the crazy thing was that I wasn't drinking. I mean, I was 2 months and I hadn't had a drink in 2 months, and I just couldn't believe that. A couple of drinking dreams in between there, and I swore I'd drink. It's like I'm still telling myself, there's no way I could have went 3 months now without a drink. At some point in time, I must have cheated. You know, I know I must have. I must have just. I don't know how this can be happening. But then I'd have to convince myself. But I would have said something at a meeting. There's no way that I could have got away with it. I've really been 3 months, and now 4 months, and got really into the steps and done a fourth step and shared that with my sponsor, and things were going crazy. Good. And they were still ready to take my house because I had fallen so far behind that, even working where I was working and then getting 2 full-time jobs, and I couldn't catch up. And the mortgage company didn't want to hear. This was before all this other foreclosure stuff. This was, 10 years ago, and they didn't want to hear about partial payment. They wanted 5 months worth of mortgage all in one, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I had to tell my wife. I said, they're going to take our house. 5 months sober. 6 months sober, and they're going to take our house. And that best friend of mine back in Columbus, his wife had taken some money out of something, and she was going to buy one of the new Volkswagens when they came out. And then she changed her mind. And out of the blue, she said, take this money and get caught up and pay me back. And I'm like, I can't do that. She said, yes, you can. And so it came in one lump sum, paid them off, and I paid them back in a year and a half. And just incredible things that would not have happened had I not stopped drinking. These things that we talk about that used to baffle us, sometime within a year sober, when I had this old beat-up truck, and the guys down there at the other club would say, you got to get rid of this truck, because one of our things is, if you want what we have, nobody wants that truck. Nobody wants, that's not showing anybody that this stuff works, You've got to get rid of that, I said, but I love this truck. My kids wouldn't go to school in it anymore. They'd rather walk, The windows don't work, all that, it was, I was able, to get a new truck but before I got that, that old truck of mine, radiator went out in it, and I was always a good starter when it came to working on something, but I could never finish a project. I'd be 12 pack into it, and the radiator's still laying in the front yard, and I'm drunk as crap, and nothing's working, and I'm pissed off, and my wife's mad at me, but this job got finished, and my truck ran, and I was like, that's one of those things. I heard somebody the other day say they bought 4 new tires all at the same time. I knew exactly what they were. I knew what they were talking about. Things that we do in sobriety that just some people do that all the time, but not us. I'm a one tire at a time guy, and buy 4 new tires. It's pretty cool. This fellowship that we have, I wouldn't trade it for the world. Central is my home group. I try to make a lot of meetings here. Things are going well at work, at home, my whole life. But it really does fall back on the spiritual growth of the program and reading the humility plaque and realizing that everything that's happening in my life today I owe to God and to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe getting off my lazy butt and at least doing the steps to the best of my ability, and then sharing that with somebody who's walking in and doesn't think this stuff might work. Because those early meetings are what really set the foundation up for, you guys are laughing and you're sharing my story. And so I know you've been where I'm at, but you don't look like you're there right now. And I want to know how you got to where you're at. So, that's what I try to do today. I continue to work these steps. Make meetings so that I can be here. I've said it before. I'm not, I didn't come to a meeting today because I felt like drinking. I'm at a meeting today because I don't feel like drinking. And I know it's because I go to meetings. I read a big book. I listen to CDs, whatever it is. Call another alcoholic. That phone does weigh a lot, though, and quick when I'm about my sponsor, because he did ask me to call him if anything was going on that he should know about. And right after I asked him to be my sponsor, his job moved him, so we weren't really at the same meetings for very much longer. And I don't like to say this too much, but it was probably a month or two before I ran into him or called my sponsor, and he said, "Why haven't you called me?" And I said, "I thought you said to call you if I felt like drinking." And he's like, "No, you dummy, you know, that's not the only time you have to call me, you know, just call me." But it was true, though, I didn't feel like drinking. And the fact that that's one of those miracles, I was sitting in a meeting, and somebody shared the fact that the only time they think about drinking is when they're in these meetings. And at that moment, I realized that it had been 24 hours. It had been the meeting the day before since I had thought about drinking. And that was probably at about 7 or 8 months sober, 9 months sober. And I just got goosebumps right then. I didn't hear anything else that was said at the meeting. But my alcoholic mind and my selfishness and self-centeredness went right to, well, you know, if you can pull that off, God, then, you know, I need some help with this and this and this and this and this and this. And luckily, I shared that with my sponsor. And one of them was looking at that glass being half full. You know, I'm just tired of going around, you know, thinking everything is, oh my God, you know, this sucks. It really does, but when it really doesn't. But if we want to look at it that way, we get that choice to look at it like it's terrible or it's fantastic, however I want to look at it. I mean, it got so good that at the place I was working, I couldn't even go in the break room for the 15-minute break or the lunch hour, because 15 minutes after that, you just want to blow your brains out. You know, this is like life is so terrible, and they don't want to hear the good stuff. You know, you go in there and try and upbeat the little conversation. They're like, "Get out of here!" You know, I don't know what you're talking about. So I just avoided them, I guess. Anyways, just the steps. I work through them with my sponsor. They're all very beneficial. I think that fifth step, I'll never forget sitting outside of the church when we done that fifth step, and then started said the sixth and seventh prayer, and started on those eighth step, you know, put that list back together, which I kind of already had. And he said, you got to take care of those. There were some things in early sobriety that I just wouldn't take care of. But if you keep coming to meetings and this stuff starts growing on you, I had to do it. I was about a year and a half sober, maybe almost 2 years sober, and I had never taken care of my driver's license. And so I knew I'm driving around with my kids, going to and from school and to dance recitals and wherever I was going with them on a bad license. And it was because I didn't want to go face the Central Florida Safety Council. I was just... And I don't know why, but I also kept hearing that you got to clean up the wreckage of your past. And every time I heard that, I it was like, oh man, I got to do this. And so I went down there finally and walked in, knowing that I'm going to end up getting that 2 years of stuff that they make you do, and going to classes and this and that, and paying $35 every time they check you when you have to pee in a cup and this and that. And I was angry because I'm sober, you guys. You can't make me do this. But one person gets to, after you do that 700,000 questionnaire, one guy's sitting there deciding your fate. And I was just, anyways, I went down there and I answered that questionnaire honestly. And the guy said, "You don't need any more. You don't need any more help. It sounds like you're on the right track." Could not believe it. Could not believe it. Just some of the amazing things that happen in sobriety. That was, you know, I've married now 19 years, and I've only been sober going on 11. So my wife put up with the last 9 years of the drinking that I did. That's just another miracle. Kids that, you know, I have a 19-year-old daughter who we like to hang out. It's just incredible. The son playing baseball and just, you know, the family deal is clicking. It's really cool. I have also a son who is still very active in the alcohol and drug use, and so I see it firsthand, the tragedies that are still going on. And from what I've learned in here, is all I can do is be an example, be there for him, be there for the children. All those things that I know that I was I just don't know where I would have been. I cringe when I hear us say, you know, I should be dead, or I would have been dead, or, and that's fine. I mean, but I don't know where I'd have been. I don't think I would have been as happy as I am today. You know, the God of my understanding might have kept me around, might not have, but I don't need to go down that road today. I know I'm very grateful today, and look forward to another day of sobriety. I'm going to keep coming back. I'm going to keep doing this deal. You know, it's a day at a time deal. But also in early sobriety, I heard somebody say that I don't have to look at it as a day at a time. I plan on being sober the rest of my life, but I can only work on staying sober one day at a time. And if I do what I the book suggests and what I've seen works with my own eyes, and keep doing that, life is pretty good, and I'm going to keep coming back. And I think that's going to wrap it up for me. Thanks.